is falling all around. Oh, and nothing is the matter, for I never cry in town. And a love like ours, my dear, is best measured when it's down. And I never buy umbrellas, 'cause there's always one around and all over.
And good morning. It's just a few seconds before 11 a.m. You are tuned KBOO Portland. Coming up at 11, Health Watch is off today. Instead, we'll hear from the series Moccasin Tracks. The guest is Indigenous rights attorney Sherry Mitchell, who talks about her Indigenous perspective and traditional views. Stay tuned at 11:30. The series Wings presents environmental tacticians, diverse strategies key to advocating for Earth. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on donate today. So I've got just a message before we go to the Moccasin Tracks.
This Tuesday, Katrina Van Den Heuvel, editor, publisher, and part owner of The Nation magazine, will be live on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. That's this Tuesday, live on KBOO 90.7 FM.
Introduce you to our guest, Sherry Mitchell from the Penobscot Nation. Welcome to Moccasin Tracks, Sherry.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great. I want to introduce you to my co-host, Dee Brightstar.
Kwai kwai, Sherry. Good to meet you.
All right.
Kwai, nice to meet you.
And Sherry, could we start out maybe if you could introduce yourself a little bit for our listeners?
Sure. My name is Sherry Mitchell. I'm from the Penobscot Nation. I'm an Indigenous rights attorney and writer and speaker, and wear many other hats in the community, do a lot of activism and organization or events within the community and around Indigenous rights issues.
I visited some of your social media sites, and I was really quite moved by some of your statements and how you've been, you know, working, of course, being a lawyer takes a lot of schooling and a certain focus. But the way that you talk about your work is really of service, and service to not just your Indigenous community, but humanity. And I was just wondering if maybe you could talk a little bit about how you evolved from just being a student of law, being an Indigenous person, and how that evolved for you.
Well, all of my education was really inspired by work that I had already been doing. And so I come from a family that has always been really involved in the community. My grandfather founded the Native Studies program at the University of Maine and the Wabanaki Center, which is a center for Native students at the university to help them to acclimate to the university environment. He raised four children, 14 children, and worked as a construction foreman during the day. He took classes in the evening, and then he did a four-hour overnight shift as a janitor at the university to pay for his education. So for years and years and years, he got very little sleep and worked very hard in order to carve a pathway for himself. And, you know, he became a man of some means later in life, but he never moved beyond his small little house on the res. Everything that he had, he gave back to the community and to other people. He worked hard to make sure if students weren't in class, every teacher knew that if one of his students wasn't in class, he wanted a phone call and he'd go and knock on their door. And so, you know, I have that kind of history. In addition to that, you know, growing up primarily with my grandparents, if anybody needed anything, if somebody needed their steps fixed or if they had a leaky roof, whatever it was, he'd say, come on, let's go. We're going to go and help this person today, or we're going to go and help that person today. My grandmother used to put bags of clothes and food together and wake me up before the sun came up and tell me to go and put them on the door of somebody's house and not to let anybody see me because she didn't want them to be ashamed. You know, so I was raised in an environment where, you know, contributions to the community, helping one another out, this real, true idea of kinship existed. And so I think that my education is kind of secondary to that way of life that I was raised with. And so when we think about, you know, being a Native person and how that correlates to a way of life, we call it Skijinawidahousewagon. And what that means, it's about living that communal lifestyle, not only with, you know, your human family, but with all of creation. And so being mindful of all of those things and constantly being aware of your actions and how they influence the greater whole. And I think that everything that I've done educationally has been supplemental to that to help facilitate greater service to the community. When I went to law school, it was after years of doing community organizing, years of doing, you know, grant writing and communications work and creating educational programs and facilitating training programs and informational programs regarding some of the issues that we were facing in our community. The decision to go to law school, again, was a supplement to the work that I was doing because I felt that it would give me a skill set that would increase my capacity to be able to serve my people. And, I mean, that's the evolution of me becoming who I am today. I think that it's really steeped in a very simple, humble way of life that was taught to me by my family to increase my capacity to live that way of life.
Some people might say that you're really lucky that you had that life way growing up.
I agree. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I think was probably most beautiful about the way that I was raised is that, you know, we had a pretty simple life, a life that most people would think of as poor. You know, we lived in a very humble house. My grandparents raised their children in a two-room house, 14 children. I grew up when I was very young, sleeping in a bed with four other people, you know, and so we didn't have a luxurious lifestyle. We lived very poor. But at the same time, we were rich in ways that other people hadn't even imagined. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I look back on that and I'm so thankful because I had no idea that the way that we were living was, you know, would be considered poor because everybody in the community was living the same lifestyle. And we, in fact, had, you know, always had food on the table. We always had more than we needed so that we could give some away. And, you know, that word is mamabisu, which means enough, which means, you know, you have enough, he or she has enough, they have enough, everybody has enough. And so having that really humble beginning, I think, has served me better than any amount of education that I could have ever received in any other forum.
Let's jump a little forward to today. There are some really serious issues facing your nation, the Penobscot Nation. Could you tell us a little bit about some of those, the water issues for one?
Yeah, there's a case right now pending regarding the water rights to the Penobscot River. This discussion needs to be framed properly in the proper context. We are Bunawabskeag, we're the Penobscot people. We live at Bunawabskeag in the Penobscot Nation. The river is Bunawabskeag. You know, there's no distinction between the people, the place, and that waterway. It's all tied to our nation, to our history here, to our way of life. And there has been a number of challenges that have come out of the governor's office and the attorney general's office in recent years challenging our rights as Native people in many ways. This is just one of many attacks that have been waged against the indigenous rights that exist here in this region. And what we believe happened, and this is, of course, you know, speculation, is that in Canada, they approved Line 9, Enbridge Line 9, which went from the west to the east through Canada. There was a proposal called the East-West Corridor here in the state of Maine, which brought an industrial corridor from a place called Coban Gore in the western side of the state over near Montreal and coming across to the eastern part of the state in Calais where it's right across the river from St. John, New Brunswick. And the belief is that they were going to put not only an industrial highway through there, but also run pipelines through there. And it lines up with some of the preliminary plans that were put out relating to this one development company. And so right after Line 9 was approved, the governor of the state of Maine and some of the other officials of the state of Maine met with individuals from Canada and with ExxonMobil. It was right after they came back from the meeting, short time after, that Maine's attorney general just issued this random statement that said that the Penobscot did not have rights to their waterways. And so, you know, the belief is that the proposal would have crossed Penobscot territory, the proposed industrial corridor, in two or three places, and it would have crossed the Penobscot River. So this seems like a preemptive strike against our rights as Native peoples in order to create a pathway for industry to come through here unobstructed. And this isn't something that's unique to the state of Maine. This is happening all across the country where we're seeing some of the biggest attacks against indigenous rights, against Native rights in 100 years. And I think that, you know, we have to really be aware of the field that we're facing right now, because we're facing termination-style policies all over again, and they're just coming under a different guise. One of the elders that I work with in another capacity said, you know, our people have gone through massacre after massacre after massacre, and today we're being massacred with words and laws. And so if the laws that exist on the books are in any way obstructive to industry, they change them in order to favor industry, despite any type of legal agreement that they have or legal obligation that they have to the tribes here in the United States. And, you know, that's problematic for people across the country. It's problematic for people across Canada as well, that these types of things are going on right now. And it's, you know, we really need all hands on deck and people to really become informed about how these things are playing out, because it's a specific strategy that's being played out across North America right now.
It's very scary.
Do you want to comment?
It is very scary.
Every day when I wake up, it's like, which Indian country is going to be try to be delineated by the colonists? What technique are they going to use next? What undercover moves can they make, like with John McCain and the Apaches? It's horrific to know that we have a person in the United States government who can be so cold-hearted and evil and conniving, I don't know how else to describe that man, to try to kill a way of life and a people. We don't do that. How many times have Native people gone out there and tried to delineate another way of life? We have never done that. And that alone should set an example that Native people are loving and caring. We want to live in harmony with the earth and with other people. But the more we do it, the more we become eugenicized. And it's still going on. And I see it every day. And it's what we need to do is just tell people about it, what's happening, and make it more public that, you know, the McCains and the other folks in Mobile are out there to become richer. And that's all they care about. And you can't live in this world with just greed. You have to live in this world with harmony and love. And that's what is so hard to make people understand.
I agree. And I think that one of the other things, what I try to do when I speak with people, you know, in the U.S. and in Canada, is to, especially non-Native people, is to help them to understand that, you know, for hundreds of years, we've been dealing with these types of things. And Felix Cohen, who is the architect of contemporary federal Indian law, he's the one that first codified everything and put it together, said that, you know, the Indian is the miner's canary. And so when we think about what's happened to Indian people over the last several hundred years in this country, we've been under a continuous attack. But we've also been under, you know, environmental and ecological attacks. There have been dumps, there have been uranium mines, there have been nuclear power plants, placed on the outskirts of our communities for generations, and we've been dealing with, you know, the health and the environmental fallout from those things for decades. Mm-hmm. And now those things that are happening to, that have been happening to Indian people and to other people on the fringe, like people in Appalachia, are starting to leak out into the commons. And so people really need to be aware that the things that happen to Indian people in this country are now starting to happen to everybody. Nobody's land rights are secure. Our waterways and our ability to live in this world in a healthy and sustainable way are being threatened. You know, there's this real nexus point between environmental justice, indigenous rights, and human survival on this planet. And people need to look at that nexus point and understand how they're connected to it, because it's not just, oh, the poor Indians. This is impacting everybody. You know, and some of the tribal lands are the last protected lands in this country. People need to start recognizing that if they don't start speaking up for the protection of Indian lands right now, then none of their rights are safe. Mm-hmm. If we have a legal system that is so changeable that they're not following their own laws, there is a trust obligation that the United States has to protect Indian territories. Mm-hmm. They're failing to meet that trust obligation. They're failed to meet that trust obligation in regard to the land swap that's occurred out at Oak Flat. They've failed to, you know, meet that obligation in regard to San Francisco Peaks and Snow Bowl. They failed to meet that obligation in regard to Bear Butte. They failed to meet that obligation, you know, over and over and over again. They failed to meet that obligation in the Everglades at Big Cypress in Florida. So there are so many things that are going on right now where the U.S. is violating standing law. They're just unilaterally changing historical agreements that they have with tribal people. They're changing policy. They're changing statutes without gaining the free, prior, and informed consent of the indigenous people, without proper consultation, which is also a requirement under the law. So they're a bunch of lawbreakers, essentially. And so if you have a government that doesn't honor its own laws in regard to one group of people, they're not going to honor their own laws in regard to any other group of people that gets in their way. And so for other people to think that they're safe and that this is just an indigenous rights issue is naive. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the message that people really need to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seems to be a moment in our lives now where water is continually so important, or displayed as being more important, like the water walkers and everybody that is aware of the fact that our waters are being polluted. I think people look at indigenous people like, well, their waterway is polluted, and that's okay because there's not many of them left and they're going to die anyway. They don't realize that our water is connected to their water, and they're not going to be able to go into a store and buy a bottle of water once we all die and have no water to drink. They don't know the connectedness of everything on Mother Earth. Mm-hmm. I think people don't realize the beauty of being connected to your brother, sister, mother, father, like you were and like I was for a long time. They go about their independent lives. They don't communicate with their children. They put them in a daycare. They put the grandparents in a nursing home to die a slow, horrible death. And I think the connectedness to people is really, really dissipating rapidly. And without that connection and that love, because Creator is in all of us. And when we abuse something, we are abusing the Creator. And how much longer can that go on? So I just try to urge people to be more respectful of each other and love each other. And don't put your grandmother in a nursing home unless you don't have any choice. It's just so harmful. And this country doesn't get it. You know, I've talked with people that are from other countries, and they say, well, we don't have nursing homes in our home. They don't exist in our land, on our island. They live in at home with my family. And when you have that going on, that love continually and that caring and respect, then the earth is going to be better cared for. I just think that circle of life has been so badly broken. So
it has. Yeah, and I think that one of the things that, you know, that makes me think of, in one of the classes that I teach, we talk about, you know, these traditional values and the distinction between indigenous values and Eurocentric, Euro-American values. And one of the things that really stands out is the fact that, you know, Native people live a communal lifestyle. We live through webs of kinship and recognize our life as being tied to our communal family. Mm-hmm. One of our creation stories talks about Glooskap, who was the man from nothing, shooting an arrow into an ash tree, and that we came out of that that crack in the ash tree. And, you know, that's not a religious belief. That is a parable that tells us that we're connected to that ash tree is our family. It reminds us that we're connected to all living beings. We're connected to the entire creation and to all life. And so, you know, you have that communal understanding. In the Western ideology, in the Eurocentric, Euro-American ideology, it's all based on individualized success.
Yep.
And so you compare those two ways of life, and, you know, when you're living an individualized life and you're cut off from community and you're not part of that kinship network, you have so much more waste than if you're living a communal lifestyle. So, you know, it's a beautiful philosophy, but it's also really practical reality. Mm-hmm. And another is, you know, being obsessed with youth and beauty in the Euro-American society. There's just this obsession with youth and beauty. And in the indigenous culture, there's a reverence for age and for the elderly and the wisdom that's attained, and seeing the beauty in what they've accumulated, knowledge and lines on their face and everything throughout life, that all of that is evidence of a life well lived, you know? And so the society tells us we need to do everything we can to erase those lines. We need to do everything we can to hold on to and maintain our youthful beauty. And, you know, indigenous culture is the opposite. I can't tell you how many young women I have had tell me, oh, I can't wait until I'm an elder and I have white hair and, you know, I get to step into this role of an elder. They look at that as being a place that's worthy of traveling to. It's something that is revered and honored rather than something that's dreaded and feared. And so all of these things speak of our relationship with one another, our relationship with the world, our relationship with ourselves and how we view ourselves. And I think that when you have a relationship with another living being, when you have a relationship with an environment, you know, I talked about there being no distinction between the land, the waters, and who we are as Wanawabskek. You know, we have a relationship with this land here. All of the blood of my ancestors is in this land, you know, so I have a tangible blood connection to the land that I grew up on. And so when we start understanding those relationships, when you have a relationship with somebody else that you care about, you treat them differently. You handle them with more care. And I think it's really about cultivating those relationships with one another, with all other living beings, and, you know, with place, that is going to really create a shift. Because, you know, we do behave differently when we develop a relationship with someone or somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really key to our path forward.
You've been studying and working on building up your skills for organizing in a nonviolent communication way. And I was just wondering if you had anything to offer us and the listeners to help us build those bridges, if you will.
Well, again, I think it comes down to relationship. You know, one of the things about doing nonviolence work is that the work that people have been doing in regard to oppositional or protest work, obstructionist type work, I think needs to have some subtle shifts. And I think that, you know, we have a word, it's a Wabanaki word, a Mi'kmaq word that called thermogonists. And what that means is using just enough force to keep the other from harming you, but not allowing, you know, anything that you do to harm them. It's just holding back the tide of harm, you know. So there is a need for obstructionist type work. What concerns me is that we have this fundamental understanding that a lot of people seem to have forgotten, and that's what basically that what we feed grows. And so if all we're feeding is animosity, judgment, finger pointing, blame, you know, and opposition, that's all we're going to create. If we want to be able to create a world that is in alignment with our vision that we hold for ourselves and our future generations, then we have to be investing our energy on building that world. You know, and so when we're doing this work in nonviolence, I think that that's the key element that needs to be taken into consideration. I also think that we really have to recognize, because you have people screaming out for their rights all the time, mm-hmm. that those rights need to be balanced with a set of responsibilities. Mm. When we talk about, our rights here as a Wabanaki people, we understand that those rights are all derived from the original agreement that we have with the Creator. You know, we agree to live in harmony with the rest of creation, and then we have the right to live here upon this land and, have access to all of the sources of our survival, because we don't look at those things as resources. They're sources of our survival. And so if we dishonor our agreement to live in balanced harmony with the rest of creation, we lose our rights, you know, to be able to maintain our way of life here on this land. And when we first started looking at, there were several people in the community. John Banks is one of them, who's been a real champion of water rights for as long as I can remember, since I was a little girl. And now his wife, Maria, I mean, they're just real champions of water rights here in our community. And, but when John and a group of people that he was working with first started looking at the river and the level of pollution that was in the Penobscot River, and thinking about what are our subsistence rights that we have to live here and to live a sustenance and subsistence lifestyle here in this waterway, there wasn't a demand that you have to honor our rights to be here. There was first step, take responsibility for cleaning the water. And they networked with groups of people all up and down the river. They took steps over the last 30 years to clean up this waterway, so that now it's a habitable place for everybody along the waterway, not just for the Penobscot people. And so when we take responsibility for the rights that we have, it creates a balanced equation. And you have people that are claiming rights. We have a right to come in here and to take your resources. We have a right to pollute your waterways. We have, you know, all of these rights. There's no balancing of those rights with any type of responsibility to the people that live along those waterways or to the entire creation. And so we have to start thinking about everything we do in regard to rights and responsibilities, so that we're able to live in a balanced way with the rest of creation. Mm. And I think that it's really important for us to be mindful of what that looks like, and what our responsibility is to living that way of life. And I think that, you know, if we can start changing some of those things, if we can start creating relationships and building networks with people outside of our circles, if we can make ourselves, human to them, if we can touch them somehow in their heart, that will change the way that they respond to us. That will change the way that they're living. Mm-hmm. If we can give them a relationship with the earth, they'll start treating it with more care. If we can start taking responsibility for creating sustainable, healthy energy sovereignty, food sovereignty, small localized community initiatives, and educational sovereignty, we can start creating a new system for others to walk into. And if we balance and harmonize vision for our future, it's going to be the world that we want to live in. It's going to be something that we can feel good about leaving to our future generation. You know, so we have to start thinking about everything that we're doing in that holistic way, rather as in individual silos of things that need to be addressed.
Yes, it's really been an honor to talk to you today, Sherry, and I hope we can have you back again sometime.
Anytime. It's a pleasure to have talked with you. Thank you so much for having me.
All right.
Thank you, Sherry. It was wonderful, and keep up your good work.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Caribou Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Nosh for Nonviolence fundraiser on Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight at participating Portland area restaurants. Nosh for Nonviolence is a collaborative fundraiser for two local domestic violence intervention agencies, the Portland Women's Crisis Line and West Women and Children's Shelter. Again, that's Nosh for Nonviolence fundraiser on Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight. You can find the list of participating Portland area restaurants at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And next, we will be going to a presentation from the series Wings. That's Women's International News Gathering Service. And the presentation is The Environmental Tacticians, Diverse Strategies, Key to Advocating for Earth. So stay tuned. Keep your dial right on KBOO.
Today on Wings.
We were all dancing while blockading.
¿Qué queremos?
Justicia climática.
¿Cuándo la queremos?
Ahora.
¿Qué queremos?
Justicia climática.
¿Cuándo la queremos?
Ahora.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Today on Wings, our topic is women strategizing for the environment. The second part of our program covers feminist activism around the international climate change process that is supposed to